to order a couple minutes after the hour and on the 2nd of April. And present we have Representative Coring, Wilson, Cisna, and something that looks like Coghill, who will be excused for 2 minutes. I understand that Representative Jewell will be a few minutes late. We have a first order of, well, order of business today is three confirmation hearings. By teleconference, we'll have Dr. Donna Peterson, Vicki McCubbin, and then in person, I saw Sally Rue walk in. There you are. Hi, Sally. And then we will go on to House Bill 407, Certificate of Need. We will not be doing anything for a couple of weeks at least on House Bill 464. And House Bill, I think it's 408, that deals with parental permission on questionnaires. I believe the sponsor has asked that to be delayed until the 9th of September, or April. If I had my way, it'd be the 9th of September. Anyways, so that's our order of business for today. We're, at the request of the speaker, going to try and end at 4:30 today. And hopefully we will deal with it. Some testimony, many amendments, perhaps, on 407, but we'll try to get to a vote on that today. At least that's my intention. So first we have Donna Peterson. Dr. Donna Peterson in Kenai. Can you hear us, Donna?
Yes, sir.
You don't need to call me sir. But we're pleased that you're willing to serve on the Professional Teachers Practicing Commission. Please tell us about yourself and your view of this responsibility.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I'm currently the superintendent of the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, have been in this position since 1999. Prior to that time, I was director of teacher education at Mesa State College in Grand Junction, Colorado, moved to Alaska in 1989, served as a teacher, a principal, and curriculum director in the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District prior to becoming superintendent. So the one superintendent position on this Professional Teaching Practices Commission is the opportunity to bring the perspective when we take a look at teachers and professionals in the education ranks and determine their fitness to teach and make decisions, life decisions about these folks. I bring a superintendent's perspective to that commission's role. Maybe I can best answer questions.
Yeah, Donna, you sure have an impressive resume here. This is Chair Dyson. Is your profession and particularly here in Alaska doing as good a job as it needs to about policing the ranks of teachers and getting rid of the bad apples?
All the way through the education profession and all the states that I've worked in, the issue of competence and value of teaching is something that's discussed at all levels. Are there bad teachers out there? I think there are teachers that need coaching, assistance, mentoring, help. And then you have to have some kind of licensing and oversight body, such as the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, to determine if what they're doing is appropriate or not appropriate. But frankly, as far as hiring and evaluating, that's a district and a site decision. And the evaluative processes in place in most districts are pretty strong about being able to take care of people that shouldn't be with our children.
Any other questions for Donna? Representing Coring.
Your last comment there, this is Vic Coring, having to do with how best should children be taken care of in the classroom as far as the instruction. How would you address the issue of somebody without the proper attitude or proper competence or whatnot that are vested in the system? Is there a way to address that?
Well, I think that
through the...
Well, first of all, we assume that once licensed or certified in the state of Alaska, they're competent. Then it's, are they the match for the position? Have they been given the opportunity to change? And I think one of the best lessons I learned as a principal was there were 25 people in my building, and they all got to the end in different ways. And so if that end is appropriate, and they're showing progress in student achievement and appropriate interactions and relationships with children, then that method of getting there was less important than the end. What I mean to say by that is we all have different styles of teaching, and those need to be recognized and supported. However, if a person isn't doing what they need to do, can you get rid of a tenured teacher, would be how I would interpret your question.
Yes.
I think that our evaluative processes are strong enough and used appropriately. They can be powerful tools in taking care of those people who aren't doing their job.
Very great. Yes, that was my question. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Donna. Now we'll go to Vicki McCubbin in... are you in Anchorage, Vicki?
Yes, I am.
Do I know you? Seems like I know you.
I'm a lifelong Alaskan.
Yeah, not quite that long. What got you down to Oregon to go to school?
I just finished school in Oregon. My undergraduate work was in Oregon.
Ah, yeah, okay. Where is Oregon College of Education, Vicki?
In Monmouth, Oregon.
Okay. All right. Well, please tell us about yourself and why you'd like to do this job and how your view of it.
As I mentioned a moment ago, I grew up in Alaska, went through Anchorage schools here. I came from a family of eight children, and I guess I just always wanted to be a teacher. And because my brothers and sisters had difficulty in school, I wanted to be a teacher that was also a leader, and I worked through the National Education Association to be not only a leader in my classroom, but with other teachers. It's been an interest of mine, and that's the role I've taken in my MEA role as an Ed Excellence and professional, adding to the profession and working with a mentoring program. And so my role on this commission, this would be my second term, is confirmed. I see it as continuing to look at the plight of teachers or superintendents or someone who has come before this commission and to make rulings as to whether they're showing the kind of leadership ethically and morally that they should be in the classroom.
During your service there, Vicki, have you all recommended somebody not stay in that their teaching position?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Does that come up, how many times a year does that generally come up to do that? Or has it in your tenure?
It has. In the time that I've been on the commission, there have been two hearings where that has happened, but there also have been times when stipulated agreements have come before us, and the recommendation has been to sanction the person's license, either through a revocation or through a suspension, and there have been several times per year when I have voted my conscience and known that I would not want to have a child of mine in that classroom and that they were not appropriate for the job.
How long have you been on the commission?
The first term was for the 3 years. I came in a little bit after someone had left, so almost 3 years.
And during that time, how many times has the commission voted to have somebody excluded from the profession?
I don't have that information readily available to me right now.
What would you guess?
About 25 times.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Vicki? Sure appreciate your service, Vicki, and your willingness to serve the children of Alaska by looking over the shoulders of the teachers. And Thanks again for your service and your willingness to do it in the future. Does this make you unpopular sometimes with the teachers?
No.
Good. Good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, we'll go Sally Rue. Greetings again.
Good afternoon.
You are up for reappointment to the state school board, right?
I am.
Now called Education and Early Development. How long have you been on the school board, Sally?
2 years. I was appointed just about exactly two years ago to fulfill Marilyn Webb's the final 2 years on her appointment.
Well, thank you for your service. Please tell us about yourself and why you'd like to continue doing this job.
Okay. I guess I'm an inveterate education junkie or something. I'm a parent of two children who have gone through the Anchorage and Juneau public school system. I feel really privileged. I feel like I've seen, as a parent, the best the system has to offer. And I want to make sure that that we spread that around so that all kids have that opportunity. I came up sort of right from the beginning of when my kids were really little in preschool as an active parent and just sort of stayed involved all the way through. And my daughter is a junior in college. My son is just about to graduate from GDHS this year. So I sort of maintained that involvement all the way through. And working in the classroom and then getting involved in, you know, school district committees and school site councils and stuff. And then I served two terms on the City and Borough of Juneau Board of Education. And then decided I needed a little break and didn't run for a third term, and then had about a year and a half off, during which I stayed involved in the local schools here. And then was appointed to the State Board of Education 2 years ago.
And you're concurrently work in the Lieutenant Governor's office?
That's right.
Chief of Staff and Special Assistant for, you were Special Assistant for Natural Resources.
Correct.
Any questions for Sally?
How long is the term for, ma'am?
5 years.
And when would it be effective?
It would be effective, I guess, immediately, because I think it was, I was actually up in January.
Can you share your thoughts in regard to tenure? Number one, is tenure appropriate? And number two, can you actually remove a teacher who has been tenured or vested in the system wherever the term is, short of criminal-like conviction or just gross negligence? Can you answer both those questions for me, please?
Well, I think, I mean, tenure, there's some good points about it, and there's some possibly some drawbacks to it. But I think you can remove teachers. It's not to say it's easy.
So you're not necessarily locked in and guaranteed a position, regardless of your competence or your ability to be able to teach in class, just because you're tenured. Is that
no?
Is that not correct, then? Because I've heard that to be the case.
No, I think teachers have to be competent. If they're not competent, they should not be teaching in a classroom.
Just by virtue of being tenured doesn't guarantee them a job, then.
Well, if they're doing their job, it does. But if they're not doing their job, I don't believe it.
How do you determine if they're doing their job or not?
Well, I think there should be, you know, good systems for professional evaluation in the system. So that every school, every district is responsible for having those tools in place and implementing them all the way along so that they're keeping track of, you know, teachers' performance and working with them when they're not performing up to a high standard.
And let me ask, in your opinion, why do we need tenure if we already have a system of evaluation in place?
Well, there are, I guess there's some arguments for it in terms of guaranteeing that teachers in a classroom can teach without fear of you know, harassment or being chased out of a system for inappropriate reasons.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again for your service and taking the time to come and talk to us today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Hello to Fran. All right, we'll take a brief at ease, and we'll go on with the ever-popular certificate of need. Ask, call the meeting back to order. What you got? Where did Representative Sisson go? All right, so I think we have some amendments that various folks will want to make. And so what my intention is, with the concurrence of the bill's prime sponsor, is to entertain the amendments, and then we'll take the public testimony. And if we get to it, you know, in the next hour and 10 minutes or so, we'll vote and, whether or not the bill moves out of this committee. Any committee members have objection to that order of business? Wait a minute. What's this?
Information from Moondog 407.
I'm sorry. What's this for?
HB 407. Technical reports.
From?
Give me a minute.
Okay. All right. So, let's see. What is the bill that we have before us is what version?
The F version, Mr. Chairman. CS for House Bill 407, the F, dated 3/21/02.
F. All right. All right. Are there amendments? This deafening silence I'm hearing. Pardon?
I thought there was going to be amendments.
Yeah, well, I've been given several I thought might come up.
Are you asking from the floor?
No, I don't think our rules allow that, sir. Well, comes from the committee. Hey, Jason.
You have a stack of amendments on it, so you can list it.
I'll just look on John,
right.
Sir.
Brief of these. Apparently I agreed that I would offer, so I will. We'll call this amendment number one. And Jason, have we made this one available to this committee?
Not yet.
Right, would you make me some copies, please?
I'll make a copy of that.
Pardon? Oh. And make enough copies for the committee and then anybody in the audience that wants one. They know what they're talking about. Okay. All right, so I move amendment number one. Is there objection? Please, somebody objects so we can have a discussion. All right. Wilson, Representative Wilson finds it objectionable. All right. And then we have somebody here who wants to make a presentation on this. Explain to us what this amendment is about and what it does. Hmm? It's this one.
Oh, can I, Jason, can I have a copy of that master?
Here, you can have mine.
Well, Honorable Chairman, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak here today regarding amendment number one.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name's Kathy Cronin. I'm the CEO of North Star Behavioral Health System in Anchorage, where I've been the CEO for the past 18 years. Essentially, what amendment number one does is it requires a facility to stay within the provisions of their original certificate of need. If they want to convert those beds to another type of bed, they would be required to go back through the certificate of need process. Why we feel that is so important at North Star is because of the large Medicaid impact on mental health beds. In 1996, the legislature recognized the need to control the expansion of nursing home beds because of the large Medicaid impact. And what we know today is that psychiatric beds are very similar. 85% of all psychiatric beds are paid for through the Medicaid system. And as funds get tighter and tighter, we feel that it's important for us to look at the best use of our state dollars in terms of treatment and to provide those dollars for where treatment is most necessary. What I've learned in the 18 years that I've worked as the CEO at North Star is that the biggest need for services is for residential treatment, which is different than hospitalization. Currently, in our state today, there are 400 Alaskan children in residential treatment centers outside the state. And I think it's really incumbent upon all of us as citizens that these kids come home and receive treatment in their home community. The only way I believe for these kids to come home is for these beds to be expanded in state. For these beds to be expanded in state, there has to be funds available to do that. If we continue to provide funding for acute intensive beds, I don't believe there'll be monies left for residential beds. So what this amendment does is, in a nutshell, protects the number of acute care psychiatric beds that are currently in the system and requires that if new beds are to be brought online, they must go through the certificate of need process. And I'd be happy to answer any questions by members of the committee.
Yeah, thank you. Now, as I understand it, what you're requesting is that if, with this amendment, if somebody changes what they're doing with the beds, and from what they had done in their original certificate of need, that you want them to go back before the department with an amendment, in essence, to their certificate of need.
Essentially, I believe it would be a new application that would explain or would prove the need for additional psychiatric beds.
Okay, so you change from what the original deal was. You want them to go back and do a new deal. Now, under Representative Coghill's bill, what about a facility that didn't have, if it passed, what would happen with a facility that didn't go through the certificate of need process and changed how a bed was being used with your amendment?
I believe under this amendment, in order to change that level of service, it would require a certificate of need.
Even if they didn't have a certificate of need to start with?
I believe so, yes.
If Representative Coghill's bill passes and becomes law, and a facility can be built without a certificate of need, why would you want them to have a certificate of need to change their what they were doing?
Well, it is our contention in the psychiatric area, and I am limiting my testimony to psychiatric care, that because of the great impact on the state budget and because of the need of expanding services, that we believe that those services should be required to go through the certificate of need.
I'm probably even dumber than I look.
No.
I'm missing something. If they don't have to go through the certificate of need to start with, why would they have to go through a certificate of need to change what they're doing?
I think that under Representative Coghill's bill, in the areas that do not require a certificate of need, they would not. I misspoke earlier. Excuse me.
All right. Is there any questions? Yes, Peggy, or Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. Here where in the amendment where it says, including on line 6, including converting adult psychiatric beds to psychiatric beds designated for adolescents and children, is there a cost, big cost difference there or something? Why would that make a difference?
The majority of Medicaid funds for mental health treatment are for children and adolescents. A much greater proportion goes for services for children and adolescents than adults. And so if we were really to analyze the fiscal impact, there would be a large change if you changed adult beds to children and adolescent beds for two reasons. There are more admissions for children and adolescents, and the length of stay for children and adolescents when they are hospitalized is much greater.
I'm just answering some questions in my mind that I have no
sure.
earthly idea what the answers are. So
sure.
Your concern, what bottom line, I know what your bill does, but bottom line, what is it, why are you concerned about that?
My bottom line concern is very simple. If you look at the cost of acute care services for mental health, it can range anywhere from $1,500 a day to $562 a day. The cost for residential treatment is $325 a day. If we truly believe as a state that it's important to bring the 400 children who are outside in treatment centers home for treatment, we need to stretch our Medicaid dollars as far as we can. If we continue to build and support or convert acute care beds at that $1,500 or $500 a day rate, I don't believe there'll be enough money left for the service that is really needed, which is residential treatment, which is reimbursed at $325 a day. So in a nutshell, what we are trying to educate the legislature about is the huge difference in payment for acute care versus residential treatment, and being able to preserve dollars so that we can expand residential treatment services so we can bring these kids home.
So in other words, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In other words, you're just wanting, instead of taking care of one patient, you want to take care of three patients.
Yes, right, that's correct. And we believe it's a more appropriate placement for these kids. I can tell you on any given day at North Star Hospital, we have 9 to 15 kids who sit in our hospital at that higher acute care rate waiting for a residential treatment bed outside the state. They shouldn't be there. They should be in a residential program, which is a different method of treatment than acute care. And I can tell exactly what it does to the kids on a daily basis. It's not healthy for them. And we hope that people will understand this and will fund those kids going to this lower level of care. It would be like keeping someone in intensive care when really they were able to be in a nursing home or into an assisted living facility is a better example. And we think it's better for the kids. And we know it's more cost effective for the state.
Thank you.
And that's what we're trying to do in a nutshell.
Thank you.
And Representative Wilson, in talking with this lady a few minutes ago, I struggled to figure out why doesn't, if the need is for residential care beds, why aren't facilities building them, and why isn't the marketplace forces of demand making it work? And maybe that's, and why do we need the government to get in here and mess with this and try to force, by forcing people to go through some kind of an approval process, what good is it going to do? So it's an intriguing question. Maybe we'll get Elmer up here later to try to help us answer it. Do you want to do that now, Elmer? Okay. Come on.
I can try and respond.
Scooch you sure. Over a little bit there one way or another.
I can try and respond from a business perspective, since, of course, we are a business and we have looked at this. The state, is, as I've already mentioned, is the primary payer. 85% of all the bills are paid by the state. When you look at the Medicaid system, the way it has been established in our state, there is a priority ranking for how items are paid. Acute care gets paid first, as it should, because people are the most ill. And then the levels of payment go down. And once the money's gone, the other items on the list are not funded at all. For many years, there have been items on the list like psychological services, social work services that never get funded because there's just not enough money to reach that whole priority ranking. My concern is if we continue to build and support that highest level of care, that most expensive level of service, as you go down that list, there's less and less money available. So as an institution that would actually have to go out and get the loan and the bricks and mortar to build the additional beds, when you look at the way the funding levels work and you look at a declining revenue budget, you get worried that there won't be any money left when it comes down to that lower level of care.
And you then, are all your acute beds filled?
Yes. But I would mention that if there were more residential beds, I don't believe all our acute care beds would be filled. Because the real need, no kids stand in line waiting to go outside for acute care treatment. But there are kids every day in our state waiting in line to go outside for residential.
And you as a professional, if you had the residential beds, you'd put them in those beds that are 2, 3, 4, 5 times cheaper because it's more appropriate, even though you would, if you put them in the acute care beds, you get a far higher reimbursement.
Right, and in fact, that's what we've done. We had two facilities, one on DeBar Road and one on Bergaw. Both were licensed as acute care facilities. We recognized that we were sending children outside at an enormous rate, and we made the decision as a facility to convert the Bergaw property to a residential treatment center, and we have been at 100% occupancy in that facility since the conversion.
Did you have to do a CON to do that conversion?
No, but we had to give up our acute care license.
And if your amendment or my amendment to this bill passes, would you have had to do a CON to convert those? All right. Any other further questions? Kathy? Elmer, you want to shed some light on this delightful subject?
That could be tough, Mr. Chairman, but I'll do my best here. Elmer Lindstrom, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. First of all, certainly want to concur with Ms. Cronin's statement, several statements, one being the need for additional residential capacity in the state. SCR 21, I believe that's a resolution previously heard in this committee. I think it's now passed both the House and the Senate. Makes that statement that we need those additional residential non-acute beds. We supported that and think that's something that needs to be done. I think we also could accept the amendment that's been proposed, except that it is in our, from our perspective, really kind of half of the equation here. We had proposed at the hearing a week ago, and I thought actually that there might well be an amendment the sponsor of the bill was going to offer related to AS 1807-031B. That is the provision in existing law that precludes the creation of any additional nursing home beds in the state by converting from another type of bed. Those are beds that we pay for, 85% of the market. We also agree with Ms. Cronin's statement that psychiatric beds are similar. Medicaid pays the freight on those beds. Therefore, it might well make good sense, if you're interested in controlling costs, wearing my payor hat with the department, Mr. Chairman, to preclude the conversion of any beds to acute psychiatric beds, because we will pay the freight. The amendment before you does that in part, Mr. Chairman, but not entirely. I believe what you really ought to consider is looking at 07031B and amending that to simply include acute psychiatric beds. The deficiency in this amendment, Mr. Chairman, is if you are not an acute care facility, but let's say you have some existing residential beds, that could be assisted living, I suppose. They could be residential beds such as Ms. Cronin operates. You could, in fact, convert those to psychiatric beds without a certificate of need. So this amendment only picks up half of the story. It would preclude a bed that's licensed as an acute bed or other health care facility. That's actually a definition of health care facility in the statute. Preclude the conversion of those beds to acute care, psychiatric care without a CON, but would not pick up a bunch of other beds that are in the universe as well, Mr. Chairman. And we think, if you're going to take this step, it really ought to be inclusive of all conversions. Did that help in any respect?
Well, you're slightly obfuscating here in lobbying for another additional amendment that's not before us yet, and I understand your interest. Why do people want to build acute psychiatric beds if there's not patients out there to fill them?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the testimony was given that those acute beds are full. I believe that's true. I believe all the existing lower level RTPC level of care beds are full. That is true. And I believe the latest numbers, I get to see numbers every month, other types of residential beds, I think, are, from the DFYS perspective, our occupancy rate this last month was something approaching 90%. So I think the real answer, Mr. Chairman, is perhaps we need capacity across the entire spectrum of care here. Now, we want to be very careful about those acute beds because they are the most expensive beds, Mr. Chairman. But all the beds are full is the short answer.
So I'm confused, and there's a piece here that I miss continually. Why would you want to put any restrictions on people going out and building all the beds they wanted and filling and then the people that need those beds would go into them?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, again, wearing the payor hat, we want to be most careful about those most expensive type of beds, and those are the beds that are controllable by the certificate of need process.
So I'll get to you in a moment. What seems to me to be missing, or what you're not saying but must be true, is if we build the beds, they will come. The beds will somehow or other get filled inappropriately just because they are there, and then you'll be on the hook, or we the taxpayers or we the citizens will be on the hook to pay for them. You're afraid that if acute beds get filled, people will end up in them that shouldn't be there. Is that fair assumption or a deduction from what you're saying or not saying?
I think that's a concern, Mr. Chairman.
I thought it might be. All right, so instead of working on the medical ethics portion of it, where we work to only get the most expensive beds filled by only the people that really need them, where you're trying to do it by controlling the number of beds that get made. Is that correct?
You're losing me, Mr. Chairman.
The best way, it would seem to me, to make sure that only the people that need the acute psychiatric beds are getting into them is to have very clear or very careful, ethical medical professionals assigning those beds, so that you, the payor, representing we, the citizens, aren't paying for anybody to be an expensive bed that shouldn't be there. And you must not have confidence that that process is working perfectly, so you're wanting to control the number of beds.
Mr. Chairman, that's a real good point. But in fact, there are a couple of different ethical dilemmas that come into play here. If you're a medical professional and you don't believe that it is medically necessary for a person to be in an acute care bed, that's the situation you're describing, that is a problem. But the ethics of a DFYS social worker, for example, that has a need to place a child somewhere, and that kid is in that acute bed, and there is no other bed to put that kid in, what is the ethical dilemma for that person? It's tricky business, Mr. Chairman.
Sure it is. So, but from that perspective, if the medical ethics of the doctors or whoever that are making the decisions of which bed to put them in, if they're doing their job ethically, not motivated by greed or something else, then you ought not to have to worry about how many acute care beds out there. If there are 100 of them empty on any given day, it's none of your business, in a sense, or your concern. But what we want is, what we're all after is to have enough beds available, you know, every day for the patients to go into only the appropriate bed and treatment?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
And you think the certificate of need helps get us there?
Mr. Chairman, we think the certificate of need is a tool, one tool, to help us control the number of those most expensive acute care beds. And if it is your desire to proceed with this amendment seems to be have concluded the same. I was simply pointing out that it is really only half of the picture,
right,
here that you're
right.
dealing with.
Kathy, I see you're jumping up and down to say something. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think your example is a good one. But let me just give you a real-life practical experience of what happens. If a family is faced with the decision of admitting their child to a residential treatment center in Salt Lake City or keeping them at home, many families will choose to keep the child at home. Oftentimes what happens is they keep them at home and the child decompensates and ends up going to acute care. I would highly...
You used a word,
decompensates? Gets worse.
Pardon?
Gets worse, clinically gets worse. One of the challenges in our area of healthcare is it's not as clear cut as a broken arm. You don't go to the hospital and someone look at an x-ray and say, oh, this person has a broken arm, and we know what to do. So what happens is the child needs a level of care. In many cases, it's not hospitalization. But we don't have the services available in Alaska, and so they don't go outside for treatment because the families want to keep them home. I mean, most families want to keep their families intact. And because they don't have the ability to cope with the problem to begin with, that's how they get to that point, the kid continues to get worse and worse and worse and ends up being hospitalized. I think it's you know, the number of reviews that a patient must go through to be hospitalized internally and externally through through the various review agencies, it's pretty hard to imagine that someone would be admitted to a hospital inappropriately. The problem is there are not the services available that they can get the treatment they need when they need it.
All right, Representative Wilson.
I can't remember who would have wanted now.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, two other very quick comments regarding this amendment. I don't believe this amendment was drafted by either Ledge Legal or the Department of Law. I don't know that the reference to converting adult psychiatric beds to psychiatric beds designated for adolescents and children, exactly what that might mean. I mean, I know what the intent is and what we're trying to accomplish, and again, don't even necessarily disagree with it, but there is not a separate category of licensure for residential or for adolescent beds as opposed to adult beds. So just technically, I would not be very entirely confident that this language is legally what you need to get where we know the amendment's trying to go. And I believe on line 12, delete sections 1 through 12, that ought to actually read delete sections 1 through 11 and insert sections 1 through 12 on line 13, at least if it's working from the version F, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any further questions? Representative Caulfield, do you want to express yourself on this?
Well, this is not an issue that that I personally wanted to weigh in on. I agree that it's something that probably needs to be discussed. And when we had the amendment, I mean, when we had the resolution before us, it became apparent that this was an issue we're going to have to deal with. This puts it under the CON provision. And I guess I'd have to agree with Elmer that if we're going to do this, we probably better do the other. I just didn't want to carry the weight of this because I don't understand everything I know about this. I'm learning as fast as I can.
Yeah. So I'm going to risk offending you here, Mr. Coghill. We are not going to get this done today. And
I appreciate that.
Yeah. And it is too weighty for us to hurry through, you know. And so I had also apparently made a commitment that I would lay this amendment. I'm going to call number two here. It's Lauterbach F.3 here. So what I'm going to do, rightly or wrongly, is I'm going to withdraw the amendment that I've already put forward. Want this one distributed. And Kathy, I'll give you a couple of minutes to explain it. This one.
Okay.
And then we're going to take all the public testimony we can get today, you know, and this will give people time to consider this. And you and Representative Coghill can decide whether or not to put the other piece in that Commissioner Lindstrom feels would make it a package, you know, that apparently addresses the issue. So you want to briefly explain what this one does?
Sure. Thank you again. Amendment 2 that is now before you essentially just establishes a work group that creates a master plan for children's mental health services. And as we've already discussed at some detail, we have a bit of a crisis here. We've got 400 kids outside the state in treatment. We have funding issues. And really what I believe we need and what this amendment provides for is a master plan on how to best treat mental health children with mental health needs within the state of Alaska and how to do that in the most financially sound manner.
Okay, and then for myself as a potential, at least, person making this amendment, you have to convince me between now and Thursday why this fits in a certificate of need bill.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And that might be an uphill fight.
Okay.
And I appreciate the sponsors here not wanting his bill to be a proverbial Christmas tree that everybody hangs their special needs on, and so on. But I'll also tell you, just parenthetically, the issue you're addressing of the 400 and some kids we have outside, I think they're averaging over $800 a day, something like that, that we're paying for the ones outside, or $635 or something, is a grave concern, both from the economic one, but the kids being away from their families. So I'm sympathetic on the issue. I need some convincing that this is the vehicle to accomplish what apparently we both agree on.
Okay.
All right?
Yes.
All right. So now back to, and I wanted to get most of the public hearing and public testimony taken care of on this. Are there people here in the room that won't be able to conveniently return to testify on Thursday? All right. I will take youth. I'll take one of you, and then I'm going to go to each one of the LIOs, and then we'll keep going around and around until we get everybody. So why don't you come first? And please make your testimony as concise as you can. I'm going to ask everybody to limit to 2 minutes if you can.
Sure.
And don't feel the need to repeat everything somebody else said ahead of you.
I'll try not to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Holm. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I'm a member of the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital Association Board of Directors. And I'm also a local businessman in Fairbanks, and I've come here today to give you our assessment of what this CON change might well do to us. Let me give you a little history about Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. In 1967, there was a flood in Fairbanks, if you recall.
I was there.
You were there. Well, if you may know, or you may not know, that St. Joseph Hospital was the only hospital we had there at that time, and it was being run by the Sisters of Providence of the Catholic Church, and the hospital was damaged sufficiently enough that the Sisters of Providence decided that they could no longer support the medical and healthcare needs of the people of Fairbanks. And so the community itself got together. And with the visionaries such as Dr. William R. Wood and Harry Red Porter and people that have been there for many, many years, they set up a foundation to see what we could do about a community, creating its own hospital, providing the healthcare in as good as we could for the people of Fairbanks. And so consequently, those of us, I'm one, but there's many others that gave a few dollars when we didn't have money to help get this thing off on its feet. And then over the past 30 years, this hospital has become a really fine institution. Fairbanks Memorial Hospital provides the lowest ambulatory surgery care in the state of Alaska today. We, in addition, provide home care, which costs us in excess of $250,000 more than we recover. We provide many other services that are not profitable, such as inebriate programs, neonatal facility, adult psychiatric care, and emergency room care for non-payers.
You summarized, Jim?
Is it 2 minutes already? Sure. Is it really that good? Well, I just wanted to say that we have 25 members of our community that serve on this board of directors for no compensation. We believe that this needs to be looked at more carefully, because we think that it can adversely affect our ability to function because of the fact that we are required to provide services without compensation. And so if we are put in a position where our services can be cherry-picked and taken away so that we cannot afford the services we have to provide for free, then it could negatively impact our hospital. And with that, I thank you for letting me testify.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry for our time constraint. Any questions for Jim? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Go to Kenai. We've got Dennis Murray. Can you hear us, Dennis?
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on the legislation. For the record, my name is Dennis Murray. I'm the administrator at Heritage Place Nursing Facility in Soldotna, Alaska. I would like to speak in opposition to the passage of HB 407. I'm particularly concerned about the fiscal note that's attached to the legislation. It suggests that the elimination of certificate of need process for the health facility construction in our three major population centers would significantly increase the general fund obligation to the state of Alaska. I would acknowledge that in my experience, the certificate of need statute is not perfect. I don't, however, believe that the state will be well served by removing that process from two-thirds of the state population. As a member of the legislature's long-term care task force, I know that our committee wrestled with the balance between community nursing home beds and other community options. As the language is indicated in the current legislation, that initiative and what the legislature passed 2 years ago would be negated, as I understand it, from the bill that's before you, at least in those major communities. Importantly, in many ways, Alaska is one large community. What happens in Anchorage will, with regard to facility construction, has an impact on the Kenai. That is why the existing certificate of need process with the current thresholds allows for public oversight and scrutiny in the construction of publicly supported services. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would just parenthetically note that I have a copy of the amendment number one that I know the chair can lay on the table, but if I read that amendment, I think it goes beyond what was discussed. If I understand it correctly, it would be any bed. So I'm in an acute care hospital and I have 20 surge beds and four ICU beds, and I need to expand ICU to serve the community. If I read this correctly, I would be precluded of doing that. I'm not an acute care administrator, but I would caution you that, in my reading of it, that could have the unintended effect. Thanks, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. Just help me out again. Repeat the part how what happens in Anchorage is going to hurt you.
Well, I think that we're, you know, in terms of expansion of beds or no certificate of need, I think that I certainly, the history of Heritage Place Nursing Facility has been somewhat reliant on serving the needs of persons from other parts of the state, particularly Anchorage. Currently, that's not our circumstance. Unless a family lives here and has a family member in acute care or something in Anchorage. But I do think that we are impacted as a nursing facility, and certainly acute care is impacted. I was speaking generically there, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions? All right, we'll go now to Fairbanks. Kathy Dunnan or Dunnan?
Hyman.
Please give us your testimony. Thank you, Kathy. Any questions for Kathy? All right. We'll come back here. Who is the next person in the back? Yes, sir.
Good
Mr. Chairman, members of the committees, I'm Mike Powers, administrator at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. To the previous testifier, Kathy Diamond, I apologize for anything that may have gone wrong and would be glad to sit down and figure out what happened. Just want you to know that the hospital loses $100,000 on cardiac rehab and that we're the only ones willing to provide that in the community at the moment. What's happening with the CON is playing out across the country right now. And you pick up headlines, whether it's USA Today or newspapers in Ohio or Pennsylvania, wherever, you'll see a lot of the same problems. And a lot of it relates to struggles between hospitals and physicians and the problems, unfortunately, that are at risk when there's both ethical and financial concerns. In Indiana, USA Today reports hospitals nationwide are engaging in medical arms race, scrambling to build specialized cancer and cardiac programs and other niche service lines, especially in a few states where the CON has been eliminated. One expert notes supply often dictates demand in the healthcare industry, and oversupply of facilities means more procedures performed whether they need to or not. New York, Rome Memorial Hospital. Rome Memorial Ambulatory Surgery Center in January filed a suit against Rome Memorial Hospital alleging 120-bed facility drove the outpatient clinic out of business by negotiating an exclusive agreement with Blue Cross Blue Shield, the area's largest insurer. And in court papers, the hospital counters that the for-profit center was cherry-picking the most lucrative cases and refusing to take uninsured and high-risk patients with only secondary regard to the public health and patient needs of the larger community. Syracuse, New York. Hospitals lose patients as for-profit surgery centers siphon off profits. One hospital files for bankruptcy. Last summer, a center specialized in orthopedic surgery opened 10 miles from Syracuse Community Hospital, located 2 miles away, and the schedule opened in March. The hospital expects to lose 3,400 same-day surgeries a year, more than half its annual volume. Meanwhile, Krauss Memorial filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection earlier this year. Quote, at some point, the community's got to come face-to-face with the issue. This is eroding the ability of the hospitals to maintain.
Mike, you're going to run out of time here pretty quick. You may want to make some copies of that, and I'll make sure everybody in the committee gets it.
Very good. The point is, throughout the nation, across the nation, Syracuse, Pennsylvania, Idaho, Ohio, Washington, this issue is playing out, and you have something very unique in Alaska, and that is a very fragile health environment with a sparse population. To propose a bill that essentially lifts any need for scrutiny or business planning could have dire effects on virtually every community in this state. Thank you for your time.
Oh yeah, thank you, and thanks for your coming down to talk to us. Are you saying that even the communities that, the small communities, that they're gonna have, you said your word was dire consequences?
I think the concerns are Fairbanks, the Mat-Su, the Kenai, and Juneau in particular. I would argue that probably even Anchorage is at risk. You do not see managed care companies in the state. You don't see whipsawing of blocks of business back and forth between.
You said every community.
I don't believe Wrangell's in dire straits if there's no CON.
Or all of Western Alaska?
Yeah.
Okay,
that's
so
true. Only those with any significance, 20,000 population and above.
Okay, I'm glad I gave you a chance to clarify that, because you did say dire consequence, I thought, for every community. All right, and if you'll want us to make copies of that, I'll be glad to.
Very good. Thank you for your time.
Mike? All right, thank you, Mike. I want to go back to Fairbanks, Janice Wilkinson.
Healthcare.
where there's a healthy competition, the medical interviews, and I've seen what happens when there is places where one medical facility has too much control or power, they gain control over the community, these were increased, there was no incentive to meet personal needs of the community individual, and people found the need to go elsewhere, taking the revenue out of the community. The facility and the community was hurt. Fairbanks needs more competition between its medical entities. Sheriff estimates has had such a massive amount of unrestricted growth over the last year, it's developed into more or less monopoly in key areas, and it's growing in other ways to create more of a monopoly. My concern, well, I'd like to give you two visualizations to think about. The amoeba and the movie The Blob. In both instances, the entity grows and moves around, it sucks up food, and in the movie The Blob, anything it touches in the way of a person is devoured. Quite large and massive. I would like to see Fairbanks have more of a competition incentive. I would like to see Fairbanks have an alternative outpatient student center, and I would like to see some healthy competition between medical entities to keep costs down. I would like to ensure the revenue within for surgery stays in Alaska and doesn't go elsewhere instead of being lost to the lower 48. I support House Bill 407, Senate Bill 256, unlike you.
Well, thank you, Janice. Come back to any questions for Janice? All right, come back, Barbara.
Good afternoon. My name is Barbara Fleming. I serve on the board of directors of Providence Hospital here in the state of Alaska. I also sit as a trustee delegate for the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association, as well as the Region 9 American Hospital Association board member. So I've many hats on this issue. During the past 100 years, the Sisters of Providence have been in Alaska, and they've served hundreds of thousands of Alaskans by providing health care, education, and food for the underserved, regardless of their ability to pay. Additionally, Providence has provided medical care where none has existed before and served those that no one else would serve. Providence serves the expanding population of seniors, children, and families, and has been proactive in lowering emergency room costs by operating a family practice clinic that allows care by accepting patients on Medicaid and Medicare, sliding fee scales, insurance, and those in need of charity care. Providence opposes HB 407 because it will put many of the existing programs in jeopardy. HB 407 will allow for new competing surgery centers to be built without any review, consideration of whether or not the community can financially support them. Statistics nationwide indicate there is a duplication of medical services, which has contributed to the increasing costs of health care. Providence provides services that we know will not be reimbursed. 5 years ago, the charity care Providence provided was roughly $11 million. Today, it has risen to nearly $36 million. Of that, and approximately $10 million of that is in community benefits. For places like the Brother Francis and Covenant House, daily hot meals, roughly 200 of such, to the Brother Francis shelter, and many other charitable organizations, roughly 50 just to those in the Anchorage area. Our greatest concern is in maintaining the programs that we already have in place and increasing those that we know are going to grow, such as our Cancer Therapy Center. Who will offer these medical services if Providence does not? By eliminating the CON process in these urban areas would allow for new surgery centers that only serve a small number of patients who can afford the ability to pay. This could quickly erode the financial stability of our medical center and its ability to provide the many reimbursed costs truly operating in complete, for a complete medical center for all Alaskans. Quickly, I also have a concern regarding to the 55,000 population limit. And I beg to differ a bit here because I think it does affect a lot of the small communities in the state. I spent 10 years in Seward. I recently moved to Anchorage, and the medical center there is a Providence facility. They've supported that facility in the past 5 years to roughly $7 million in the red. They would not be able to do that if they didn't have a stable base in Anchorage through the medical center. Outreach as far as Seward, they deserve that. People of Anchorage deserve quality care for their parents in Providence's long-term care facilities. People across the region rely on home health care. And also, you know, the 3,100 roughly FTEs at the medical center deserve quality daycare for their kids.
Sorry, the 3,100 what?
FTEs at the medical center, full-time employees or full-time equivalents.
We don't speak an acronym.
Sorry, I apologize. I was trying to be brief. These services are in jeopardy because they all have red ink on their books, and those things would not be able to happen had the medical center not had the stability. By changing the CON and allowing independent centers to open in the larger cities, it will affect our ability to provide the much-needed services that people across the state are accustomed to. Again, we serve everyone without regardless of ability to pay. I beg, can I have 30 more seconds, sir? Thank you. These independents, they don't have a responsibility to the community as Providence does through these surgery centers. If Providence doesn't do this, who else will? The state will be left holding the bag for even greater increases to the Medicaid budget. One last point. I know you've heard a lot of conflicting information regarding the cost increases versus savings. For FY 2003, the state's total Medicaid budget was $830 million. Of this, $32 million was a general fund increase. Therefore, the state's Medicaid budget roughly increased by 23%. This is a dramatic jump, and with my association at the state and national levels, the forecast is gloomy. You can't afford to speculate on these costs, and again, I strongly oppose, as well as Providence, the HB 407. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for Art? I'd just like to say that in an earlier conversation today, I understood from talking to Barbara that the portions of the business that Providence provides that produce, you all don't use the word profit, but I mm-hmm. say excess revenues, mm-hmm. are used to subsidize the many charitable things that they do, and it subsidizes the hospital in Seward mm-hmm. and yeah. Brother Francis Shelter mm-hmm. and subsidizes all the people that come to the emergency room that don't pay.
That's correct.
And other services that don't do it. Mm-hmm. So part of the argument, as I understood it, is if a competing business comes along mm-hmm. and takes those portions of the business on which you generate the most excess revenues, not profits, excess revenues, then you would not be able to subsidize the many other things you do, and then those costs, when ended up being downloaded to the state, would drive up the state's Medicaid. Aid mm-hmm. bills, and to the detriment of all the citizens.
Right.
Did I get your argument correct?
You did. Very well. Thank you.
All right. My wife is training me to be a good listener. So, you know, So that was kind of a summary of what I understood from a former conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll go back to, is there anybody else here in the room that for whom it's inconvenient to return to testify on Thursday? Are you waving your hand? All right, I'll get you after we get the next person that's in Fairbanks. And as I understand it, Fairbanks is the only other, the LIO that we have people lined up to testify? Okay, and I got somebody off net. Have we gotten everybody that's off net? No, I've got a Mr. Watts. We'll see if we can get to him.
I'm right here. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Are you Watts?
Yes, I am. My name is Carolyn Watts, and I am a professor of health economics and health policy at the University of Washington in Seattle.
And you're representing the Fairbanks
Memorial? I'm representing Fairbanks Hospital. I'm also representing my own experience and research in the area of certificate of need and healthcare organization delivery.
All right, and we've got an extensive resume here from you. All right, now that makes sense to me.
Okay.
All right, please, if you can, summarize, but tell us, give us the benefit of your expertise.
Okay, well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today by phone. I appreciate your time. And I would like to testify in opposition to HB 407. As I mentioned, as you see in my CV, I've worked in the healthcare area for 27 years doing teaching and research in the area of health economics and health policy, much of which has revolved around the organization of the healthcare industry and its financing and certificate of need in particular. And I have several points that I wanted to make, some of which have been made before, and I won't reiterate those. But I'd like to say a couple things in response to the speakers that I have heard. First of all, Mr. Chairman, your summary of the argument made by the speaker from Providence, I think, is exactly correct. The issue here is the financing of healthcare at the present time and for the foreseeable future is this fragile interdependent web of cross-subsidies and indirect financing that if everybody would say, okay, we value health care and we're willing to pay taxes to support public programs to provide services to people that can't pay for their own, we wouldn't need cross-subsidies and we could do competition and everything would be fine. But that isn't the way the healthcare world works now. It isn't likely to be that way in the near future. So you can't look at this the way you look at the market for pizza. In pizza, competition's great. If competition drives the pizza parlor out of business, you eat Chinese. You can't do that with healthcare. It's too important. It is part of the essential community infrastructure, particularly in a state like Alaska. And I do think that certificate of need is an important piece of the puzzle for the whole state, not just for the smaller communities. Some of the other speakers talked about freedom and choice and control and power, supply and demand forces. Again, this isn't pizza. There are many things in communities in Alaska, including Anchorage, where people know when they go there, they're not going to have a lot of choices because the population density won't support a lot of choice. There are other industries, even in the lower 48, where we choose not to have choice because stability is so important. I mean, with all the Enron debacles and so forth, we understand that there are some parts of the community infrastructure that are so important that we want to make sure that we always have access to the services. The issue about ambulatory surgery in Fairbanks in particular, there were three certificates of need competing actually for the state's attention in 1999. All three of them were reviewed by the state and the state concluded that there wasn't any need for any of them, would be until the year 2017, I think it was. So the issue of not enough capacity in Fairbanks in particular seems, that issue has already been addressed. The real issue is, do you want to have hospital services in these communities in Alaska at all? If you allow the intrusion of the entrepreneurs, and there are plenty of them out there who will come in, not as members of the community necessarily, but as entrepreneurs, and take the profitable services away from the provinces and the Fairbanks Memorial Hospitals and the other facilities, and just deal with the patients who can pay, and leave the hospitals with the legal and moral obligation to treat anybody and everybody who comes to them, those hospitals will have several choices. They can shut down the services that don't pay for themselves, in which case nobody has access. And so the person who said she didn't want to see people in Alaska going to the lower 48 for services, that's what will happen.
Can you summarize, Carol and Cindy?
Yes. So the important thing is certificate of need is not about excluding a particular facility or service. It's about creating a process whereby communities, in many cases which have funded their hospitals, can decide where and what kind of competition they want to introduce. So certificate of need doesn't prohibit competition. It provides a mechanism to monitor it and to make sure that it's consistent with community goals, that it allows them to be good community stewards of community resources. I think the impact on Medicaid of this piece of legislation could be very large. The person who spoke in the beginning about the psychiatric beds, 85% of which are covered by Medicaid. If you restrict one part of the market, particularly in a community like Fairbanks where there isn't a psych hospital, where do all the people who can't get into nursing homes and psychiatric beds go? They go to the community hospital. If the community hospital is failing financially because the entrepreneurs have come in and sucked off all the profitable services, there's not going to be that capacity. So everybody in the community suffers. The Medicaid budget suffers. Everybody in the community suffers. Again, I would say that the impact on Medicaid expenditures is much more complex than is presented in the little thing from information insights that you got. Secondly, that certificate of need is not about prohibiting the building of a specific facility or even about prohibiting competition. It's about maintaining a process through which...
Carolyn, you already said that.
Okay. And finally, the issue of competition in healthcare is very different from competition in other industries.
Thank you.
It's not about government control. It's about community stewardship.
All right. Thank you. Other questions? Yeah. Representative Coring has a question.
Thank you, Dr. Watts. Vic Coring here, member of the committee. I was going through some of your papers here, and it looks like you have a very extensive background, and certainly I am impressed by that. However, looking on page 13, I see that you've done some papers on national health insurance. Just in a very short, brief synopsis way, if possible, Can you tell us what your thoughts are on that particular issue? It is germane.
It
is germane to this issue as far as the legislation, which is why I'm asking the question. But do you support or not support health insurance on a national level?
Well, I'm primarily a researcher and an educator, and so I have I guess I don't have a professional opinion on whether we should or shouldn't have national health insurance. My job is to talk about what would happen if we did, what happens now that we don't. But I don't have a particular push on whether we should or shouldn't.
I'm concerned that the direction we would be moving in, or we are actually, without this legislation, is essentially in the direction of socialized medicine, which we've proven in the history of the world, frankly, like with Canada and other countries, that it is not in the best interest of those countries.
I disagree with you on all of those points, respectfully, sir.
Okay, that's not the issue for us, Cindy. Thank you for that. Are you on contract with Fairbanks Memorial? Yeah.
They asked me to provide the testimony, yes.
Were you paid for that?
I was.
Okay, thank you, and I appreciate it. And please don't take our questions here as adversarial, and I'll maybe back in touch with you, and I'm looking forward to reading some of your papers. We'll go now to you, sir. And then we're going to suspend the public hearing until Thursday. I think we've gotten to everybody and to the rest of the folks. There's some more folks in the Fairbanks LIO. Sorry about our time constraints, and we'll try to get you in on Thursday. Thank you. And you can submit your testimony in writing or by fax or email. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Soley. I'm from Fairbanks. I grew up there, and I am a trustee on the Greater Fairbanks Community Hospital Foundation Board of Trustees. I also serve a night job as an elected member of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. I'm not here to represent their views, but I am here to tell you that I've sat where you're sitting, and I'm willing to talk about community needs and community concerns. And I am very concerned with this legislation. I oppose House Bill 407. I think the CON process, while it has problems, modified in this fashion, won't make it better. In fact, I think it's going to create further problems. It would allow for cherry-picking of selective services, and it would hurt at least our hospital in Fairbanks' ability to pay for some of the things that we've mentioned that are not the services that a for-profit venture would pick up, or at least not pick them up with the ability and the desire and the mission to continue them. What concerns me an awful lot, frankly, is that I remember being in, I think it was even this committee room a couple of years ago on this very same issue. And there was a lot of talk about certificate of need and the fact that we wanted competition. Well, I think I studied economics in college, got my degree there, and had a father that was a PhD in it. And I can tell you, healthcare is not an economics textbook 101, and the situation in this state is not economics 101. So I think what we need to do is start talking about how we move in that direction. And I fear that a discussion at this level, with 20 days or 30 days left in the legislature, and we're limited to 2 minutes, doesn't allow for factual discussion of issues. We talked about a task force 2 years ago, and there was a lot of talk about doing an interim task force to look at the real problems with CON. Our hospital foundation has some problems with it. It is an uneven playing field right now. Physicians are able to get services from their clinic that we have to get a certificate of need approved by the state. So there is not a level playing field. And earlier I saw an amendment proposed that I didn't even understand, and the committee chose, I think, wisely to not adopt it. But I'm concerned that there's a piecemeal approach to trying to fix a certificate of need because of the laudable view that we should move towards a competitive process. But I don't think that this is the best way to do it through legislation at this time in the second session of a legislature. If you truly want to fix a process that you see has problems, then please be willing to spend the time through an interim to study it. In Fairbanks, we have people that have spent the better part of 30 years trying to create a healthcare system that can provide an array of services and a quality and a cost and with access for all of those that come. We provide home care today. A few years ago, there were others that provided home care. They are gone today. Our mission, we talked about mandates and mission. Frankly, there's probably more mission that drives us than there are mandates. We have an emergency room that's open to all those that can't pay. We will be there tomorrow for those that can't pay, regardless of race or color or their problems. We take all comers. We have mental health. We have the neonatal care. We have a cardiac rehab. We could go on with that list. In the absence of a competitive arena, I suggest you look at cost, quality, and access. In our hospital's case in Fairbanks, we have audited data from the state that shows our inpatient prices are competitive statewide. In fact, we're the low-cost full-service provider. Our outpatient service prices are the low-cost. We compete with the freestanding center in Anchorage, and our prices are competitive with those.
Can you summarize, Rick?
I can. You're getting cost, you're getting quality, and I suggest we're getting access. If you want to fix this, let's talk about a task force, because that's really the best way. I thank you for your time, and I think the 55,000-person threshold seems like it doesn't have basis. In fact, I think our administrator would talk about concerns over a lack of a service category when you come to things like cardiac. There isn't even addressing that issue here. So this is very serious. We wouldn't have come here as volunteers to talk to you if it weren't. I do thank you for the committee's time. And
I thank you, and I appreciate the frustration it must produce for those of you that have a dog in this fight or are very concerned about the time constraints and so on. This is a pile of letters that I received today on this issue, and I will get through them. And I've gotten lots of emails. I've had several conversations, lengthy conversation today and in the past, and I suspect my colleagues here have had as many, and you know, we're, I think, trying to do a responsible job and get on top of understanding the issue, and I do believe it's quite complex and isn't just like any other economic entity and service provider. We're going to adjourn the meeting now, and thank you for your patience, and